This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The 2007 movie Once, which told of young musicians in love, introduced a song called Falling Slowly. It was sung by the film's two stars, Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova, who also performed it at that year's Oscars. They had fallen in love while making the movie, and at the Academy Awards, they won for Best Original Song. The press embraced their love story as a sort of real-life fairy tale, but it wasn't happily ever after. Shortly after the Oscars, their romance dimmed. But their friendship and their musical partnership did not. Hansard and Irglova continue to make music together. Their band, The Swell Seasons, has just released a new album. It's called Strict Joy, and here's the opening song called Low Rising.
I wanna sit you down and talk. I wanna pull back the veils and find out what it is I've done wrong. I wanna tear these curtains down. I want you to meet me somewhere tonight in this old tourist town. And we'll go low rising. Cause we've gotta come up, we've gotta come up low rising. Cause there's no further for us to fall. Low rising. Cause I feel I've had enough. And we're low rising. Oh, for the love of you.
The movie Once presented Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova as characters whose pasts closely resemble the people who play them. He's a street musician from Dublin, and she's a recent immigrant from the Czech Republic. They meet, share a love of music and performing, and find themselves connecting both musically and personally. Glenn Hansard also is known for his work in the band The Frames. The writer and director of Once, John Carney, used to be in The Frames. Terry spoke with Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova last year. They began with the big song from the movie, Falling Slowly.
Glenn Hansard, Markita Irglova, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the Oscar and all the success you've had with Once. You co-wrote Falling Slowly. Had you ever written a song together before writing for the film?
No, that was actually the first song we wrote together. And it was one of those things where I'd been working on the song and I wasn't really sure where I was going with it. All I had was, you know, it was the verse and I had an idea for the chorus. And it was only when I sat down with Mar and I played her the idea because I was talking about a harmony in the chorus and she said, well, what if you take the lower one and or you take the higher one and I'll take the lower one and, you know, on the moment where it goes, we've still got time. And she and it was, for me, that was like the key of what made the song suddenly work. And then so I wrote the chorus with Mar and then I really felt like we had a solid song in our hand and it was something that I could give to John and feel confident with.
Markita, you were cast before Glenn was. How did you get the part? You hadn't acted before.
No, well, John Carney, the director, approached Glenn about this, you know, as you know, about the idea for this film. And throughout the years, they'd met many years in cafes over teas and coffees and discussed the idea of the film. And when the project was getting closer to happening, John said to Glenn, well, you know, the only thing is I have Cillian Murphy for the male part, but I can't find a woman for the female part. I have trouble finding this woman because I want it to be an Eastern European woman who can sing and play piano and act. And, you know, would you know any people? Because you travel a lot. And Glenn said, well, yeah, I know a girl from Czech Republic, and she does play piano and sing, and I'm sure she could pull off the acting, but the thing is, she's only 17, and John was looking for a 35-year-old woman originally. And so John kind of thought that 17 years old was too young, but he decided to meet me anyway. And so I just got on the plane to Dublin from Prague and met John, the director, and just kind of played a few tunes on the piano for him, and that was my audition, really. He didn't get me to read any lines or anything. He just cast me right then and there. And that was it. I was part of the project.
You were 17 when the movie was shot?
Yeah.
Wow, that's right. You don't look it. You really look older in it.
I know, it's funny. Even now people meet me in person and they tell me I look much younger than in the film, and it's ironic because I'm now older than I was in the film. So it's a funny thing.
Since neither of you were really actors when you started making Once, although Glenn, you had a part in The Commitments as a member of the band, did you go seeking advice from people about how to act or how to behave in front of a camera? Did you just learn from doing it? And if you got advice, like, what's the best thing that you were each told that actually helped you?
Well, the thing that I was told, and I can't remember who told me right now, somebody said to me, just remember that Marlon Brando was always Marlon Brando. He wasn't, like, the reason people hired him to be in films is because he was Marlon Brando. I kind of like the idea that no matter what character you're playing, no matter whether you embody it or not, and there are many different styles of acting, of course, there are many different styles, but this was the thing that I always, that resonated with me most, was the fact that just be yourself and embody the character. And I think that for me, that meant that my range as an actor was probably quite limited. And let's face it, I was pretty much playing myself in this film. I am a street musician. I was a street musician. I fixed bicycles and not Hoovers. John changed that detail, I guess. When I went to the bank to get my first loan for the frames, the bank manager took out his guitar and played me a song. So there are many details in this guy's life that are very similar to my own.
I want to play a scene from the beginning of Once. And this is a scene where, Glenn, you're playing on the street for money, but no one's paying any attention to you at all. And until, Marchetta, you walk over and start asking him questions about himself and the music. Here's the scene.
This song you just played, you write it?
Working on it.
It's not an established song?
No, it's not an established song.
How come you don't play during daytime? I see you every day.
You know, during the day, people want to hear songs they know, just songs that they recognize. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't make any money. I play these songs at night. They wouldn't listen.
I listen.
Yeah, but you give me 10 cents.
Well, you do it for money, then? Why don't you get a job in a shop?
I have a job in a shop. Listen, I'm going to get back to this, yeah? Nice to meet you.
Who'd you write this song for, please?
No one.
Where is she?
She's gone.
She's dead?
No, she's not dead. She's gone.
You love her still?
Jesus, man.
You're over her. Rubbish. No one wrote this song is over her. I'm telling you. You play this marvelous song to her, you get her back.
I don't want her back.
Glenn, you started out off as a street musician when you were in your teens. You dropped out of high school to play on the streets. Where did you choose to play? Like, what was a good street for you in Dublin?
Well, for me, Grafton Street was a bit like in Dublin, if you can imagine, if you know, the microcosm of your life, I suppose. For me, I lived on the north side of the city. So Grafton Street was on the south side of the city. And that for me made most sense, because it meant that I wouldn't bump into anybody from school, and that I wouldn't bump into any of my mother's friends, or my mother indeed, because my mother was a fruit seller on Moore Street, which is on the north side of the city, and I wanted to get as far away from anybody I knew as possible. So I went over to Grafton Street, and also Grafton Street was kind of the more posh part of Dublin, so the chances of me having a career or getting beyond just being a street musician were, I had better chances, if you like, on the south side of the city, because that's kind of where all the artists lived. And you know, so I went over there, and it was a great, for me, it was the beginning of a whole new education. I mean, I left school at 13. I went over there. The day I left school, I went busking. And what started was I met a man who sold magazines on the street. His name was Pete. And Pete was he prided himself on the fact that he was a Dylanologist. You know, he loved Dylan, loved everything about it. Yep. And because I was such a Dylan fan, this guy took me seriously, because I was playing Dylan songs that weren't necessarily the ones from the greatest hits record. And so this guy was took an interest in me, and I guess took me under his wing. And I remember going and living with him for a while, and he took me around to like poetry readings. And pretty much from there on, I remember meeting this lady, Philippa Garner, who was a kind of a famous painter in Ireland. And she took me out to her house in Kildare, which was in the countryside. She lived in an old converted schoolhouse that she had rebuilt. And I went and lived with her for 2 years. And really a whole new education began. I remember staying at Seamus Heaney's house when I was a kid, and getting to hang out with poets and other musicians was really the basis of my artistic beginnings.
So what's the best thing that happened to you on the streets?
Well, for me, I guess, overall, it was my education. I learned how to sing on Grafton Street. I learned how to entertain. When you're on the street, you're a still point. You know, you're part of the architecture. You're a still. And if you stand still on any street in any city, in any country in the world, if you stand still long enough, every single person in that city will pass you by. So, like, you know, I'd be busking and Van Morrison would walk past as I was singing a Van Morrison song, or, you know, Bono would go by. Or,
is that true?
You know,
really?
They'd go by? Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so Van Morrison was walking by. What do you do? Do you say, excuse me?
Not at all, no. With someone like Van, you would just give him his space. I mean, and actually, ironically, the reason I guess he was passing by was because myself and my friend were busking together, and we were singing Van, because Van songs are amazing to busk. So one day we were busking, playing one of his songs, and he passed by. But actually the irony was that we were busking enough money to go see him that night. So actually we ended up busking up enough money to go see him. And the same thing happened to us with you too. We were busking up the money to go see them one time, and we saw them the same day, which is very interesting.
So Glenn, when you dropped out of school at the age of, what, 14, so that you could perform on the streets, what did your parents think of that?
Well, I'm very lucky in that my mother... Again, my mother was very, very liberal. She grew up in a very, very tight household where she had to be home at a certain time, and that, you know, she had 12 brothers and sisters, and I guess if the family had to keep everybody, from, you know, herd them together, I guess, if you like. So my mother grew up in the 60s, you know, and so during that time she wanted basically to give her kids the freedom that she never had. So my mother was like very, very liberal. She said to me, anytime you need, you know, if you want to, you know, when I came home to her and said, Mara, I really want to do music, my mother just said, well, do it then. And she said, well, do it, and if you're going to do it properly, so go, you know, go and earn a living from it and do it and getting really involved in it. So I was lucky. And my dad was, my dad was one of those guys who was, he worked hard, but he was a hard drinking man and supported us in whatever we wanted to do, but didn't really play much of a role in our lives except to say, yeah, fair play to your son, go for it. You know, so my dad was, I guess, was on board with it too. I was very, very lucky. I mean, my headmaster in school, my head teacher, he was a great guy. I was in his office so many times. And we talked and talked, and I guess he was a smart guy. He figured out that music was the one subject I really enjoyed talking about. And because he was in his spare time, he was a DJ. And so myself and himself would talk about Dylan and Cohen and Neil Young and all the stuff that really impassioned me. And he basically said to me one day, he called me down to the office and he says, Glenn, you know what? You're in this school, you're not learning a thing, you're frustrating all of the teachers, and I know you love music. So I have an idea. Why don't you go, take your guitar, go over to Grafton Street or go to any street you want, but start your musical career at the very bottom today. He said, you know, go and, you know, take your guitar out. And if in a year you're not enjoying it or it's not working out for you, come back to school and I'll figure out a way of getting you back into class and you can continue your education. He says, but I don't think that your education is going anywhere. He says, you know, he says, you can tell me all the musicians who played on John Wesley Harding, or you can, you know, you can tell me who produced the first two Leonard Cohen records, but you can't tell me the square root of nine. And he says, so you're not really very good to us here, and I'd like to see you succeed. So he sent me home that day to take my guitar and go to the Grafton Street. And when I went home, I said to my mother, I dropped my school bag in the hall and I said to my mother, Ma, I'm gonna start my career as a musician. And my mother was like, what, really? And I was like, yeah. She says, well, go for it, son, and good luck.
That worked out. And Marquetta, how did your parents feel when you, at the age of 17, took a break from school, left home, went to another country to make a movie?
Well, first of all, like Glenn's parents, my parents are very liberal themselves. So they, you know, it's not like they ever restricted me much in you know, whatever I wanted to do. But I guess there was, you know, they were always concerned ever since Glenn came into my life as a musician who left school at 13. You know, I think they were always concerned that I would just forget about school and try walk in his footsteps. And they were only concerned about that because they wanted me to have something to fall back on in case music didn't work out or something, you know. But at the same time, I think I was always, I always had a very good sense of that if I was quite sensible at home and if I didn't get into too much trouble, then I'd have that freedom because they would trust me and they'd kind of know that I'll be all right on my own. And so I stayed out of trouble and I did all my homework in school. And for that, I had the freedom to travel and miss out on school at times. So it, you know, was great. And they did, and they're, my parents are very supportive, you know, so they would have never kind of stood between me and my dreams or anything like that. So I'm very thankful to them for that.
I want to ask you about another scene from Once. There's a great scene in what I think is a pub. It almost looks like a living room, but I think it's actually like a small pub. And everybody's kind of eating dinner and drinking. And the rule of the game here is that you have to be able to sing to be in on this dinner. And people just kind of alternate singing. And there's a kind of middle-aged woman and a middle-aged man, or slightly older man, who sing a few bars in this sequence. And they have really interesting voices. And I was wondering, like, who are they? And is this based on a real pub in Dublin?
Well, actually, that room is where me and Mara live.
Oh!
And because we didn't have money to hire a venue, we decided to have a party in our flat.
No wonder it looks like an apartment. Okay.
Yeah, so that's our place. That's where we live. And also, the guy I was telling you about earlier on, the first person I met, the Dylanologist in Grafton Street, that's Pete, and he's the guy who sings.
Oh!
And then the woman who sings is my mother.
No.
Yeah, that's my mother, Catherine. So, and again, how we did it was, instead of trying to hire a room and put lots of extras in it, we just threw a party and invited all our friends over and filmed
great.
It.
I really liked her voice. You know, there was something vaguely Marianne Faithful-ish about it.
Yeah. Oh, well, interestingly,
the older Marianne Faithful.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Marianne Faithful used to live in that flat also, which you might have somehow picked up on. Yeah. We're very lucky in that we live. One of the other people that I met when I was younger was Marina Guinness, who's part of the Guinness family in Ireland. And like, Ireland doesn't have royalty, but if we did have royalty, it would have to be the Guinness family, because they're such a strong and powerful family in Ireland in a very nice way. And of course, we all admire them because we drink their product constantly. It's an amazing thing. So, but I'm really glad you pointed out the guy and the woman, because the guy is the guy I was talking about, who took me on board, and I spent a lot of time with him when I was younger, and of course, my mother.
Now we have to play that scene.
Great to see you here. Can you sing? You can't sing your own.
There's one request I'll ask of you when your liberty came. Remember Mitchell far away, a convict bound in chain.
Mine that once held this heart of mine.
That's a scene from Once, which stars my guests Glenn Hansard and Marquetta Erglova, who are both musicians and songwriters who are performing together. Did your mother sing a lot when you were growing up?
Yeah, my mother sang constantly when we were kids, my father. My mother used to win, like, she won a bunch of competitions when we were kids, you know, in pubs and, you know, my mother, of course, never took singing as seriously as, say, I did, but, you know, and my father. My grandfather was an opera singer, and my grandfather sang I remember my great-grandfather sang in the same competition as James Joyce and beat him, apparently, in an opera. competition a long time ago. So music's definitely been in my family.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us, and congratulations on your lives together and on the success of Once and your music. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova speaking to Terry Gross last year. Their new album as the band The Swell Season is called Strict Joy and has just been released. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Roy DiCarava, the man who became a famous photographer by taking pictures of everyday life in Harlem, died Tuesday in Manhattan. He was 89 years old. DiCarava was born in 1919 and grew up in Harlem at a time when it was a center of artistic and literary life. His photographs, covering more than half a century of Harlem, have been exhibited by many museums and collected in several books. Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, and John Coltrane are some of the musicians he photographed at work and at play. In 1952, Roy DiCarava became the first African-American photographer to win a Guggenheim Fellowship. It enabled him to spend a full year taking pictures of daily life in Harlem. Terry spoke with him in 1996. One of his Harlem photos from 1952 is called Man Coming Up Subway Stairs. The man looks like he's returning from a long, hard day of work. He's wearing a rumpled shirt with the sleeves rolled up and the top button open. He's carrying his jacket. He's biting his lower lip as he walks up the stairs. Terry asked Roy DiCarava what led to that picture.
I was working 9 to 5, and I used to, with like everybody else, I woke up in the morning and went to work and came home, and I was tired, and I was very much aware of my fellow riders and their appearances and their feelings, and I thought, in a sense, that this was a remarkable experience in the sense that these were the people who went to work every day, worked hard, and their lives were rather circumscribed, and in many ways they were borderline in sense in how they lived. And in a way, I thought that their consistency and their perseverance was in itself a rather heroic thing. And so that this was that picture which I sort of planned. I planned in the sense that I'd seen these kinds of images every day for years. And there was no doubt that I would, when I decided to take a picture, that I would find one that would come along. And so what I did, I established the hours from 4 to 6, so I had to find a place. So I opted for the entrance or the exit of a subway. But it had to be one of those subway stations that have disappeared, but they had a kiosk, which is this overhead covering, and the walls were made of glass, wired glass, and I managed to find one, believe it or not, with a hole in it so that I could stand on the side and wait for this gentleman or person or woman to come up the stairs. And he eventually did, and he was perfect.
What made him perfect?
Well, he had all of the things that one associates with being tired and yet constant. I mean, he was determined. I mean, he was determined to get home, or maybe he was just determined to get up at the top of the stairs, because he was very tired. And to prove it, when he got to the landing, he rested, which gave me a chance to put another roll of film into the camera, because at that time I only had one exposure left, and I was debating whether I should wait until he got there or put in another roll. So when he stopped to rest on the landing, I was able to put another roll of film in. And so when he got there, I had plenty of film to case I needed to take more than one. But fortunately, I only needed that one anyway.
Now, did you ever find out who this man was, and did he ever find out that you took a now-celebrated photograph of him?
No, I don't think so. People generally, I don't know. I really, I'd have no idea. This was taken a long time ago, and I've never had any anybody say anything to me about it, so I imagine not.
I'd like to ask you about the photograph that's on the cover of your Museum of Modern Art catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of a woman walking down the steps, taken, I believe, in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And the photograph ends at about her, just right above her waist. Mm-hmm. So basically you see her coat, you know, the bottom half of her coat. You see one mm-hmm. arm, you see two legs sticking out from under this long coat. We have no idea who she is or anything about her. But in a way, it reminds me of the kind of image I see a lot, like if I'm looking down or if I'm looking up, but I'm not looking up far enough
mm-hmm.
to see a person's whole body. Tell me why you framed it this way. Why were you just seeing the bottom half of her body?
Well, because the body talks to you. The body says things to you. You don't have to see a face to know. You can see a body. A person's way they carry themselves. Every individual is unique in that sense and in every sense. So that there's, I guess, for want of a better phrase, it's body language. The body tells you, your feet, your legs, how you walk, how you stand, how you relax. They tell you things. And I thought that this was a very beautiful moment. It was a very delicate kind of image of a woman, definitely a woman, and it was beautiful. It was, I liked it.
One of my favorite of your series of photos of jazz musicians is a backstage photo. It's during a session break with the Ellington Orchestra, mm-hmm. taken in 1954.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's such a beautiful composition of repose and disarray.
Right.
Because it's backstage, you know, in the center yeah. of the photograph is a coat rack. On either side of the coat rack is a jazz musician. They're each facing in opposite directions. They're each facing yeah. the wall. They're sitting on folding chairs, each reading something. I can't tell
yeah.
whether it's, you know, sheet music
yeah.
or
right.
the newspaper. And there's, you know, folding chairs kind of scattered around and a lot of
yeah.
overhead lights.
Right.
But it's such a...
You have good eyes.
Oh, thanks. It's such a kind of quiet moment and
yeah. Yeah, I understand. I feel the same way about it. You know, one of the things that is important to me is that one doesn't have to be so literal and so narrow in one perception of say music. Music is a very broad category, if you will, and the musicians to me are very important. So it really is not so much about their playing. Singularly, you know, photographing, playing something, but it's about my interest in them as people and how they
mm-hmm.
how they respond to what they do and what they do, you know, like when they relax or when they go somewhere. You know, the idea that musicians are entertainers and then after they're entertaining, they disappear. They don't disappear. They go home, they go to their families or their friends, and they eat like we do, so I'm interested in all of that, and their resting is certainly one that is very important to me and very beautiful. You know, it's not just the act itself. It's a kind of a perception of them in their total environment as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
one of the things I really love about your photographs is the lighting. Many of your photographs, I'd venture to say most of the photographs of yours that I've seen, are really pretty dark with very subtle shades of, you know, grays and blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly a work of art. It's not reality. This looks different mm-hmm. than reality because
right,
of the lighting.
Right.
And I'm wondering what inspired you to go for that very dark, atmospheric lighting that almost reminds me of certain film noir.
Uh-huh. Well, it's first of all, I have to confess that it's what I like. I love the tonal scale, the photographic scale, which means simply the range of tone from black to white. It's so unique. There's no other process that can give you this kind of tonality, and I'm in love with that. And in addition to which, when I photograph, I accept the lighting conditions, whatever they are. And I try not to say, well, you can't photograph that because it's too dark or there's not enough light. I don't believe in that. I believe if I can see it, I can photograph it. And I accept the outcome in the sense that it is black and white, and that in itself removes it from reality. And a lot of the things that I do, for instance, are in the subway, and the subway is not exactly daylight, and people, even in people's homes, in terms of the technology, the film is sensitive, but in order to really show it, you have to really print it what I call full. And that tends to be on the dark side. Let's say if, you know, 50% is this and 50%, it tends to be more on the dark side of 50. And that doesn't bother me at all. In fact, it gives it a luminosity that you can't get by printing normally. And what we consider normal is the information. In other words, one of the things that one gets in a photograph is information, and I would rather sacrifice the information in terms of details and things like that mm-hmm. for a feeling of mood.
Yeah, yeah. Did you resist color when color came
about? I didn't resist it. It just didn't attract to me. I wasn't never attracted to it because I didn't... at first, I didn't like the garishness of it. The color, when it was first introduced, was very garish.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not like that. But the main reason I don't use it is because it particularizes too much. It becomes... It's very difficult to do a color photograph without thinking about color first and not what the photograph is about. Because color tends to be arbitrary, especially when you're dealing with human beings who dress up brightly when they're feeling sad, and when they're feeling bright, they may have on a black suit.
Now, I know your mother moved to New York from Jamaica when I believe she was 17.
Right.
And she raised you as a single mother. Was she very determined that you would succeed? Did she push you?
No, she protected me. Which is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
She cared about me, and she was very, she was really very concerned about me and very attached and caring. And she wanted me to do things. I mean, she loved music, so she wanted me to be a musician. And she loved the violin, so she wanted me to play the violin. But I remember the turning point in our relationship, I think, her perception of me, was when that a teacher from the public school system came to my house and told my mother that I was very gifted and that she should encourage me, because the teacher was very encouraging. She had bought me a paint set and was very much concerned with my future. And she took the time to come to my house and talk to my mother about me. And I thought that was I look back now, and I can hardly see that happening nowadays. But it was a beautiful thing, I think, on the part of the teacher. And my mother took her seriously, and from then on she encouraged me to do and be what I wanted to be, you know, which was to draw and to pursue that avenue.
Now, in one of the catalog essays for the catalog of your photography show, it explains that you were drafted in 1942 and that you had a terrible experience.
43,
okay.
Yeah.
But it says you had a really bad experience in the military and that you were in a psychiatric ward for about a month and ended up with a medical discharge. What happened? Did you have a nervous breakdown?
I guess you'd call it that, yeah. And it was... it was the conditions of, I hate to even think about it. It was just very uncomfortable and very mean and destructive, not only to me, but to so many black soldiers. Because at that time there were two armies, you know, one was black and one was white. And the only reason for the separation is to treat black people different from white people. And that's what happened in the army. And in the army there is no such thing as democracy. and you had to do what you were told, and they tried to break you down and make you a soldier, you know, which was something that went against what I was. So I had a difficult time, but I'm glad to be out of it, and I no longer have nightmares.
How did being a soldier go against who you were?
Well, because there was no... Well, because it was... You had to do things. You were forced to do things that you had really no interest in. And I didn't like the idea of killing people. I didn't like the idea of being killed. I didn't like the whole destructive thing that the army is made for. It's made, you can define it as protection, you can define it as this and that and the other, but the end result is about killing and not be killed, and that was too, that to me is not a very civilized position to be in.
So what was your month in the psychiatric ward like?
Well, it was where I learned about democracy.
What do you mean?
I mean, it was the only place in the whole United States Army where we weren't segregated. So we weren't really the crazy ones. It was the people outside who were crazy.
That's interesting. So did it change your sense of yourself when you got out of the Army? Did you see yourself differently than you did before you got in?
Yeah, I valued myself more.
That's interesting, because you think that kind of experience would kind of break you down and that you'd lose self-esteem.
Well, if I stayed in there long enough, I probably would have. And that's what I was fighting against.
So tell me about coming out and feeling like you valued yourself more.
Well, I just looked at the sky and I looked at the ground and I said, hallelujah. I was free to go and do as I please and to pursue my life in a way that was constructive. You know, I didn't have to learn how to shoot and how to do this and do that. And I felt that I could live. No one told me when to get up. No one was overtly cruel to me and mean and authoritarian. And no, it was wonderful to be free, to get up in the morning and be responsible for yourself.
What kind of subject matter would you say interests you most now in your photography?
I think what it's about is my feelings. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that it's what I look at and it's how I feel about things that really is what I'm dealing with, not so much the subject as how I feel about the subject. And the subject can be anything, depending how I feel at that moment. So that really it's about my perceptions that I'm really trying to express. And my perceptions are the same perceptions that other human beings feel. So therefore, I have a kinship with that.
Well, Roy DeCarava, I want to thank you very much. And congratulations on your show.
Thank you. And I hope that you liked it, and I hope that people liked it. And I was glad that I was invited to talk about it. Thank you.
Roy DeCarava, speaking to Terry Gross in 1996 about his retrospective, which started at the Museum of Modern Art. The famous Harlem photographer died Tuesday at age 89. To see a gallery of his work, including his backstage photograph of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, visit freshair.npr.org.
Okay, this is the harmonies and the vocal harmonies on the choruses of Beat It. I'll do the verses, then I'll do the choruses. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Michael Jackson died on June 25th. He was in the midst of rehearsals for a series of 50 comeback concerts in London's O2 Arena under the title This Is It. Now instead, there's a film called This Is It, which documents Jackson's last weeks of rehearsal at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. The director of both the concert and the film, Kenny Ortega, first gained fame as the choreographer of Dirty Dancing and recently directed Disney's High School Musical movies. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Few documentaries have been creepier in prospect than This Is It, the sadly apt title for a quick assembly of Michael Jackson's final rehearsal footage, shot while he was preparing for a run of 50 comeback concerts in London. Anonymous sources after Jackson's death spoke of Michael's druggy frailty, the loss of his voice, his grief at being unable at age 50 to fill his own shoes, the shoes of the 23-year-old king of pop. So I braced myself to watch Sony and a bunch of Jackson estate greedheads squeeze the last dollar out of a moonwalking skeleton. Well, that skeleton moonwalks pretty well and dances better than almost anyone who's ever lived. And the movie is vivid and illuminating and sometimes, more often than you'd think possible, inspiring. Watching these numbers, superbly choreographed and designed, and close to finished, you see that the London concert series wasn't an inherently doomed enterprise. Touch and go, certainly. Jackson was striving for the impossible, to go on stage one last time and be as he had been. This Is It gives you no context and offers no posthumous commentary on the trajectory of Jackson's life. It's just process. It would probably have ended up as a DVD supplement to a concert film. The huge and splashy show was to feature his big hits, from ABC through Billie Jean in black and white, with elaborate multimedia interpolations, among them updates of the incomparable Thriller and Smooth Criminal videos. Jackson did nothing small. The challenge for the film's director, Kenny Ortega, who was also directing the stage show, was to remind us why Jackson was the king of pop, but also leave in signs of vulnerability. If the film had been edited to make Jackson seem too on top of his game, or morbid curiosity about his imminent demise would go unsatisfied. If he brought out too much of Jackson's instability, the charge of exploitation would be even harder to fight. Ortega gets the balance right. Jackson's legs are pool cue thin, so that every time he lands, you fear a crack. Yet when Ortega splits the screen into run-throughs on two or three different days, Michael's dancing is awesomely on point. A choreographer explains to auditioning dancers that it's not just athleticism that's required. If you don't have that goo, she says, that ooze coming out of you, you're not going to get the job. Which sounds alarming, but makes sense. The dancing is snap and ooze, violent spasm and simmer. And Jackson's not just keeping up with the young troupe. He's credibly leading them. Before the final round of auditions, Ortega tells prospects that dancers in a Michael Jackson show are an extension of Michael Jackson, and they do seem projections of his will. He dictates every beat to his dancers, musicians, and crew.
I gotta cue that. I gotta cue that. Yeah. That shouldn't trigger on its own.
That should be a special.
That can't trigger on its own.
Our girl.
Jackson emerges here as a control freak, but one who uses the word love as a mantra, perhaps because his dad was reportedly so harsh. It's not right, but that's okay, he says, then adds, it's all for love, then adds, just get it there. His singing voice had a long way to get there, and he calls out from the stage that he's saving it, conserving his throat. In some numbers, his vocals have clearly been sweetened after the fact, but Ortega leaves in enough wobbly notes to let you know that even the oohs and yips were an effort. One of the techies gushes that Jackson always has to push the boundaries in his work, which must have been especially terrifying to a performer whose boundaries had already been pushed as far as any humans can go. No, he wasn't fully up to it. And that white face and nose whittled down to cartilage is spooky to behold. But This Is It is still worth treasuring. Like all great artists, outside their scandals and behind their mythical facades, Jackson was working, hitting his marks, working, trying to hit the notes, always working. His discipline and drive outlasted his body. but it's captured here on screen forever.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli.
This is it. Here I stand. I'm the light of the world. I feel grand. This love I can feel. Thank you.